From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, how the decision not to expand Medicaid in Texas is costing the state billions of dollars. Texas has won the war on Christmas. A new law protects the religious icons of the holiday, but is the law being followed? And a conversation with author Amy Tan. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies.
Any doubt, we wanted to put it clearly to bed that Texas wasn't going to be a part of it, expanding, socializing of our medicine.
Right.
So we're not going to participate in exchanges. We're not going to expand Medicaid. We're just not going to be a part of, again, socializing health care in the state of Texas.
That was Governor Rick Perry on Fox News saying that he was not going to participate in the Affordable Care Act, including the expansion of Medicaid in Texas. Texas is the state with the most uninsured, and the expansion of Medicaid would have provided health care to about 2 million people in the state. A report out this week explains how much the opt-out decision is costing the state. The report is by the Commonwealth Fund, a private foundation working towards a high-performance health system. The report titled How States Stand to Gain or Lose Federal Funds by Opting In or Out of the Medicaid Expansion is co-authored by Sherry Gleed, a former Obama administration health planning official who is now dean of NYU's Robert F. Wagner Graduate School of Public Service.
So what we were looking at in the study is trying to think about the Medicaid expansion, not in terms of a healthcare program, but just in terms of one of the many things the federal government does that moves funds among the states. So in thinking of it that way, we thought about, first of all, comparing it to other ways that the federal government moves money among the states, such as through defense procurement contracts or highway transportation funds. And we found that on average, the Medicaid expansion is about a quarter as large as defense procurement contracts that move to the states and about and much larger than the highway transportation funds that states get each year. So it's a big flow of federal funds that's associated with Medicaid expansion. The second thing we did is look at how the money that came into states through the Medicaid expansion would compare to what they would have to pay out in taxes to all the other states expanding if they chose not to participate. And that's where we find that Texas winds up spending a lot of money. Texas taxpayers pay a lot of money for the Medicaid expansion happening in other states.
So looking at the money flow only, so you're not concerned with politics and you're not really concerned with health outcomes?
That's right. We were just looking at it as if it were just plain money.
So how much is Texas giving up?
Somewhere around $10 billion. So, yes, that $9.6 billion is money that Texas taxpayers will pay towards Medicaid expansions happening in all states other than Texas if Texas chooses not to expand.
So let's talk a little bit about how we got here, because during the creation to the legislative process in D.C. of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, Medicaid expansion was supposed to be happening across the states uniformly. Why was that?
Originally, everyone expected that all the states would participate in the Medicaid expansion because the penalty for not participating, at least in principle, was the loss of all Medicaid funds. Then the Supreme Court ruled that actually the federal government could not withdraw all Medicaid funds. They could only withdraw the Medicaid funds associated with the expansion itself.
So this is part of the Supreme Court decision. They decided that that the federal government doesn't have the authority to order the states to expand Medicaid because it would be a violation of state sovereignty. You're laying out a very compelling argument. You know, there's a lot of money on the table for states to benefit from, that they would be able to expand their health coverage for the most poor and vulnerable citizens in the state, but states are refusing to go along with this.
So I think what's happened, really, if you look at it, is that states have really focused on the share of the Medicaid expansion that they themselves would have to pay, because they will be on the line for 10% of the cost of the expansion beginning in 2020. They have said, look, we don't want to raise our taxes. We don't want to raise taxes in our state to pay for the Medicaid expansion. You know, technically speaking, that's correct, because they as state legislators don't have to raise taxes if they don't accept the Medicaid expansion. The problem is that whether they choose to do it or not, the same people in their states are also federal taxpayers And as federal taxpayers, they will still have to pay the higher taxes. They just won't get any benefit.
One out of every $10 the state would have to pay for the Medicaid expansion by 2020.
Right.
They don't want to come up with that.
They don't want to come up with that money. At least that's what they're saying. They don't want to come up with that money. But the problem is that 9 out of every $10 is coming out of the federal government, and they have to come up with that money for all the other states, whether they expand or they don't. So because it's federal tax money, you don't get a break on that just because your state decided not to take Medicaid.
According to the figures I see, Texas would be eligible for $164 billion in federal aid to pay for the expansion through 2020. But Texas leaders would say that Texas' share of that would be $27 billion, and they say that would be a heavy burden for the state.
Right, that's right. But the problem is that it's not like the rest of the money is going to go away. In effect, Texas taxpayers pay for the Medicaid expansion in all the other states. All this money leaves Texas to pay for Medicaid expansions elsewhere, and none of it comes back. So the net financial flow to Texas is much worse by not taking the expansion than it would be if they did.
Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst, who's running for re-election, says the system is broken, and adding 2 million more people onto Medicaid will not solve the problem. So is the system broken?
Well, I mean, every state runs its own Medicaid system, and in my view, the system is not broken. We have pretty compelling evidence. I see very compelling evidence that people who have Medicaid have better access to medical care than people who are uninsured. Surely Medicaid could work better than it does in many places, and I would encourage everybody, governors and everyone else, to work on making Medicaid even better. But there is no question at all that people who have Medicaid do better than people who are uninsured.
Sherry Gleed is dean of the NYU Robert F. Wagner Graduate School of Public Service. She is also a former Obama administration health planning official. She is a researcher and co-author of a study that demonstrates that Texas will lose billions of dollars in federal funds by not expanding Medicaid. On June 13th, Governor Rick Perry signed into law the Texas Merry Christmas Law. That makes it now not illegal to say Merry Christmas in public schools and other public spaces in Texas. The law, HB 308, was supported by the group Texas Values, a nonprofit dedicated to preserving and advancing a culture of family values in the state. Jonathan Sines is the president of Texas Values.
For a number of years in the state of Texas, unfortunately, a lot of school districts have engaged in activities that have restricted the free speech of students and parents and administrators and staff in public schools. And it's not necessary, particularly when it comes to references to traditional winter holidays like Christmas. So we've seen students banned from putting the words Merry Christmas when sending cards to the troops in Iraq. We've seen students being told they can't call a tree a Christmas tree, they've got to call it a holiday tree. So the Merry Christmas Law makes it very clear that school districts do not have to be speech police when it comes to these issues, that students and teachers and administrators are allowed to exchange holiday greetings such as Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays and Happy Hanukkah and things of that nature. And if the school district can allow students and parents to have displays at the school for this time of year, whether it be a Santa, a reindeer, a nativity scene, things of that nature that go along with what you're used to seeing in our culture and in our state during this time of year.
Now schools can no longer, if they ever did, say, put a ban on saying Merry Christmas.
This new law makes it clear what's always been the case when it comes to the law of the land as far as courts are concerned. What this law does is eliminates the confusion that school districts think that they have when they're dealing with issues during this time of year, and tells them they don't have to ban people from saying Merry Christmas. They don't have to ban red and green. They don't have to ban students from wanting to bring scenes or symbols to school that reference Christmas, like we've seen happen in other cases throughout the state of Texas. In Plano and Katy, there have been issues like this. And so that's unfortunate. The students have the right to do this, and school districts don't have to feel like they've got to be the one policing all these ideas. They can allow them to do it. They can even allow staff to exchange greetings, such as Merry Christmas, to each other in the hallways or in their offices.
And so this is mainly at schools where we have these problems?
There's certainly a huge part of this issue comes up in public schools. And so this law is focused on the public school context because we've seen court cases in Plano, Texas. We've seen court cases in Katy, Texas. We've even seen an issue in Fort Worth where Santa was really left out in the cold by a school at one point because of confusion about the law. But the law is very clear on this issue, and so this law puts into statute what has been the case in court cases, and that students and people have freedoms to exchange greetings such as Merry Christmas, and the school districts can allow symbols of winter celebrations like Christmas and a Christmas tree or a menorah in a public school. And so the school districts do not have to ban the saying of Merry Christmas. School districts do not have to ban the colors red and green, and they shouldn't be anyway. And they do not have to be in a position either where they're banning Christmas trees and leaving Santa out in the cold.
So explain that, leaving Santa out in the cold. You made that as a reference to an actual case. Can you kind of walk me through that case?
Yeah, well, there was an issue that came up in Fort Worth where concern was raised because there was a Santa at a particular school. And I think oftentimes what happens is, you know, people think, they'll think of Santa and they think that it's a religious figure. And so they have this notion that religion or any expressions of religion or anything related to a religion should be banned from public school. That's not the law. In addition to that, the Christmas has been recognized as a federal holiday since the late 1800s. You have federal employees that are given an official holiday on Christmas. And so there's no reason for this overreaction and this type of censorship when it comes to Christmas, regardless if people think it's religious or not. And so, and I mean, we've had people call us talking about just being able to say Merry Christmas. They've been restricted from doing that. As a matter of fact, there's an issue going on in Frisco ISD right now today where this is still a conflict, and that's in the North Texas area, that that hasn't been resolved. And so there's been back and forth on whether or not they're even going to allow students to say Merry Christmas in the public school.
Well, tell me about that, because here we have this new law, and what's happening at Frisco?
Well, what's happened here is, this new law has come about making it very clear that school districts do not have to prevent and specifically says that students can say Merry Christmas and they can have displays of Christmas. The law is very clear, and it tracks Supreme Court precedent. But you have a school district right now that is not allowing that to happen. And so there's some discussion.
So did they put out a memo? Did they punish some kids? Yeah, what did they do?
So how this came about in Frisco was there was a PTA email that was sent around, and it said that specific references to Christmas would not be allowed. The colors red and green would not be allowed at holiday parties, and a Christmas tree would not be allowed. And so making it clear that there was a ban on certain references to Christmas, and there was a ban on certain colors because they are identified as being related to Christmas. And so that's specifically what this new law in Texas says is not allowed. You're not allowed to ban it, and you don't have to. They're allowed to have these type of Merry Christmas expressions in these displays. And so there's some back and forth now where trying to get straight who said what and what the actual policy is and who's implementing it. And so, but the way it, from what is being reported, the way it is now is the rules are going to be enforced where there won't be references to Christmas, there won't be references to red and green, and there won't be Christmas trees allowed. They'll be specifically banned, which is not what the law says. And specifically, the law protects school districts and gives them the freedom to allow that. And there's other laws that are in place that prevents them from banning this as well.
So now we have a law, and if you break a law, there are consequences. So what could happen now for Frisco?
Well, in addition, this issue in Frisco has caused so much outrage on the potential banning of Merry Christmas, and even the colors red and green, as absurd as that is, that a state representative has got involved. Representative Pat Fallon from Frisco has sent letters to the school districts on this issue, making them once again aware of the law, and it's still up in the air as far as what's going to happen. At this point, from all accounts, Christmas could still be banned in Frisco ISD.
Jonathan Sines is the president of Texas Values, a nonprofit dedicated to preserving and advancing a culture of family values in the state. Sines wants more people to be aware of the Merry Christmas law now in Texas, and there's more information on his website, merrychristmastexas.com. On Monday morning, December 9th, there will be a celebration in the state capital of the new Merry Christmas law. Now to follow up on the claims signs made about Frisco ISD. Frisco ISD officials were unable to go on the air to explain or defend themselves from the allegations, but they did send a written statement. They said this is an unfortunate misunderstanding that began with an email sent by a room mom, and that it has been unfairly portrayed that Frisco ISD is having violated the Merry Christmas Law. The school district says this is simply incorrect. The email being referenced was not an official PTA email, nor was the school district aware of it being sent. Frisco ISD says there never has been a ban on what is worn, what is said, and what is brought to the Christmas party. The new Texas Merry Christmas Law is consistent with the manner in which holiday parties have been handled by the district in the past. The Valley of Amazement is the latest offering from Amy Tan. The award-winning author of The Joy Luck Club and other acclaimed books takes us this time to the unconventional worlds of two women. One, an American who leaves her home in San Francisco to follow a Chinese man she loves to Shanghai. The other is her daughter, who through a series of dramatic circumstances becomes a courtesan. Amy Tan spoke with TPR's Yvette Benavides and tells her how the idea for the book came about.
It's been 8 years since we've been able to see a new Amy Tan book on the shelf.
Yes.
And your process may have been forestalled, I read, by the fact that this was not your original idea for your next book?
Right. It was. I had an interruption based on a discovery of a photo in a book. And it was a book, a photo entitled The Ten Beauties of Shanghai. And five of these women in 1910 were wearing an outfit identical to what my grandmother was wearing in her favorite, in my favorite photo of her. And they were courtesans. And I just paused and said, what does this mean? And I was so obsessed with this question that I started doing research about who courtesans were and whether or not there was any possibility she really could have been one. And I was so engrossed, I decided that I simply had to enter that world.
And did you find out in any definitive way whether or not she was?
I could never say it's definitive. I think the only way I would say it was definitive if she was standing in front of me saying it's true, or if I found a record, if I went to Shanghai and somehow unearthed a public record that said she had been. I would never make that declaration. In part, because, the way society looks upon anyone in the sex trade, we tend to look at and say that there's something morally a little odd here, that it's somewhere in their personality that enabled them to stay in that profession. Even though these girls who entered this profession often did so against their will, that they were forced or they had been kidnapped. And so that is the reason why I don't lightly jump to the conclusion that she had been. The compelling evidence, however, would suggest there was a strong likelihood, and it is because of a series of pictures that were taken, and also because of other details I found out about her life that turned out to be contradictory to earlier stories told about her.
Mm-hmm. Well, in writing about courtesans in Shanghai, your novel does get a little bit saucy. I know some people have called it 50 Shades of Tan.
I think I'm going to regret that.
Oh,
that
phrase.
Jokingly. I actually jokingly said that. I thought, oh, people, because of the gray and the tan and the colors, and I said, people are going to accuse me of that. I had written that chapter, actually, before the book came out, and then when the book came out and I was at a university, I heard women talking about it and saying, oh, well, it's not very well written, and I read all the way to the very end to see that that was true. I said, what is this book? And when I found out, I thought, oh, what is first,
why are women interested in this? And second, people are going to think I'm doing a ripoff of this book.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I have not read 50 Shades of Grey, so I don't know what is in there that might be similar, except that there apparently there's things having to do with sadomasochism or mm-hmm. whatever, bondage. And in my book, I don't think there is exactly that, but you know, there is a submissiveness in a business side of the sex. These are women who just say, "Here's what this person likes," or "Don't do this because this person carries it too far and has been known to damage other girls."
And how has all of that been received by your fans? I know you're on a book tour. How have your fans responded to that?
You know, it's really interesting. It's either we love it or we hate it. And the people who love it, you know, they go on and on about it. I just got an email from a friend of mine, and he forwarded an email from his 83-year-old mother that said, "Oh, Michael, I forgot to tell you, I'm really enjoying Amy's book, and it's hard to put down." And she said, "And I've learned a lot of new words for sexual organs."
And I
thought that was so, you know, just very so charming.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you know, I found that there are people who I guess expected a tender mother-daughter story without any allusions to sex, and those people are also quite vociferous in their objections about that.
Oh.
You know, calling it crude or, you know, whatever. And I thought it's just very interesting how we have this dichotomy in views on this subject. But, you know, sex is very polarizing, has always been polarizing.
But even in this novel, we do see the mother-daughter relationship, certainly in a completely different context. It is,
you know, there's that side of love. I think that we're, to me, the sex is, it's part of the novel. It's not really the centerpiece of the novel.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about the different kinds of love that we're seeking, and it has to do with who we are, who we become over time and experience, how we become who we are, our self-identity in the face of the way others perceive us. If you are a respected person in society and suddenly you are cast into poverty or into the role of a courtesan and people look down upon you now, how does that change how you feel about yourself? Those are the questions that I was exploring more, and they are really based on what happened in my family, the upturns and downturns in my grandmother and mother's lives. How, you know, my grandmother became a concubine, how she thought of herself when my mother went from society girl in Shanghai to poor minister's wife in a backwater. How did she think of herself? You know, when people thought she was a non-English speaking maid.
Mm-hmm.
That really is, you know, and the love that we continue to seek no matter how people see us.
Well, and your book tour will bring you to Texas. I teach at a university in San Antonio, and we have studied Joyla Club and also Mother Tongue. And my students, who are the majority of them are Mexican American, really identify with the daughters in those works. And as you suggest in the new novel, that relationship is underscored very clearly.
Yeah. I think that people, especially those who are in from immigrant families, who have bicultural families where the children are steeped in their American culture, but also part of their family's culture, much of that, the notion of who we are, our self-identity, is at play here. And of course, one of the greatest influences on young women, on or women of any age, it has to, you know, it's our mothers. Our mothers exert exert an influence on how we see ourselves from the time we are young, and we often try to break away from that at some point of our lives, whether it's at age 7, a little bit at age 7, a little bit at age 12, and so on and so forth. We are shaped by the external forces of our friends and new opportunities and the ones that our parents didn't have. We say, you know, we're beyond that. They were not college educated. We are. We're of the modern world. They're in the old country. And I think that is very common. And I'm very, very lucky that so many readers identified with that in a book I wrote that I thought was so odd, would be so particular, idiosyncratic to a strange family that was mine and not anyone else's.
You have such a wonderful relationship with your readers. It seems like you just have so much to give. And I've observed that even on Facebook, you're quite attentive to your fans and even offer to participate in these impromptu Q&As that you start. You're so generous. Why do you do that? Why do you enjoy talking to your fans on Facebook?
I go there, you know, to communicate with them, and I think that it's nice to show them I'm not the icon that they often think I am. That I'm like all of them. You know, I do have a very lucky life in being a writer, but I also face many of the same things they do. And I think they delight in that. Or they like hearing advice, and they like to hear that it is difficult for me, that they're going through those challenges, and that's normal. And that others have suffered the same disease, Lyme disease, that I have. And that we're all human, because what I'm writing about in my books is human nature. It's about human nature. It's about families. It's about the things we all share. And I have now the perspective. I've had a lot of terrible things happen to me. I don't sit back and say, why me, why me? It's, you know, the life that was given to me. And what is wonderful is that I have been able to get the perspective on it and think about it, have the chances through writing to meditate on what this means, what the meaning of my life is, and how all these factors have entered into it and created this melding of heart and mind and soul that leads me to today. And today I feel I'm a very lucky person. I'm a very grateful person. So I think usually I come to my Facebook page with typically a happy attitude, or typically an open attitude about many things. I will state my opinions on things that make me angry, but I also share a little tender moments, say with my dog or my husband and what my husband did. You know, if that gives my readers a smile, I'm very happy. And it's also let them know that I'm really grateful, because they're the ones who gave me the life I have.
Amy Tan is the author of The Joy Luck Club, The Kitchen God's Wife, The 100 Secret Senses and Other Novels, a memoir, and children's books. Her latest novel is The Valley of Amazement. It's a New York Times notable book of 2013. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Send your emails about the program to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also comment on our website at tpr.org. And that's also where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs. And you can hear us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.